Hello and welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. As always, my name is Adam Jeziorski, and I'm joined once again by my good friend, Josh Steenpot.
Hello again, Adam. Happy New Year. When we're recording this, it's almost February, but I think this is the first one we've recorded since the New Year.
I think so, too. This current arc takes a little bit of time compared to of the past ones. We're not just... riffing on stuff we know inside out, but at least the last two episodes were, but some require a little bit more prep and debate in the run-up.
Even those ones certainly did too. Yeah, they just do, and it's a busy time of year, term, all those things. So we're very much focusing on quality and not quantity of our podcast episodes, and in doing so, we continue with those core reading lists, number four of the core reading lists, I believe, sequentially.
I believe so, yep. And episode 49, believe it or not.
I've been
doing this for a while. So today, our core reading list is about using the sediments to reconstruct oxygen concentrations. And I think one of the takeaways would be that oxygen reconstructions are hard.
Yes.
And I guess maybe we have to once again do a quick recap for, the regular listeners may have forgotten what the deal is with all this. It's been so long. But again, the theme of our current episode arc is core reading lists, where we're developing introductory reading lists for a variety of paleolimnological topics. And in general, the idea is that these are the kind of things that you would whip together in a short list that you send to a new student, or not necessarily a new student, or a new project to get someone's toes wet in the greater literature as like a starting point for a particular, it's not really field, sub field most of the time.
Yeah, just topic.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we had some general ground rules, limit the number of review articles, try not to spread them out a little bit. We totally failed on that one last time. And then,
that was intentional though.
And the key thing is accessibility, not necessarily foundational texts. Ideally there'd be lots of papers that refer to potential foundational texts. That you can go and read it on your own, or as you dig in deeper. Again, the core example was, if someone is just starting to show an interest in like evolution, for example, you would not go, all right, go read The Origin of Species, and then we'll start talking about your project. It's like,
that's right. Yeah, exactly. The most foundational are not always the most accessible, or the most flushed out. The other example we often say at the intro here is Watson and Crick's article on the structure of DNA in Nature is not, it's a very short little piece. It doesn't give you the full details of the story. So it may be the starting point for that topic, but not necessarily if you're trying to learn about it.
Exactly. All right.
So oxygen reconstructions in the sediment.
Yeah, and I've been involved in a couple of projects that involved oxygen reconstructions. You may be familiar that, or like listeners may be already be jumping to the idea that, okay, we're doing a chronomid episode, as that is a paleo indicator we've talked about before in terms of reconstructing oxygen from sediments. And that is true. It's going
to
focus
to some extent, yeah.
Focus largely on oxygen reconstructions. And I've been involved in a couple of projects where I did something like this. And I think one of the first papers I would send would both be it's a bit of a curveball, and then it's both quite recent in, in relative terms, and is not a paleo paper.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about this list, is that there are a couple as we go through that aren't truly paleo papers. But what I have found is these are papers that are really cited a lot by paleo papers, especially considering how new they tend to be.
Yeah. And so I, you know, in the past, it's like when talking to a new student about Austrian reconstructions, it's almost an element of, it seems rather esoteric in some ways initially. It's a little bit different than, you know, pH reconstructions, for example. It's like, you know, I've, huge amounts of the of the flora and fauna will potentially die as the pH changes too much. And they go, well, oxygen, yep. You know, there's periods of time where parts of lakes go anoxic on a natural basis, you know, at the very bottom. And it's a much more, I guess, of a gradient that could occur through the water column. So reconstructing it can be difficult. And so the first paper that I would put on this week's list is Guzzo et al. 2017. It's a PNAS paper. And it is behavioral responses to annual temperature variation alter the dominant energy pathway growth and condition of a cold water predator. And so it is a paper looking at lake trout and basically showing that in the summer, as oxygen becomes limiting in the hypolimnion, and the epilimnion becomes quite warmer, the kind of like safe zone of the lake for these large cold water fish becomes very limited and totally impacts their general behavior and where they forage. And, you know, they're doing less than ideal things throughout their life cycle to survive.
Yeah, they're squeezed thermally and where they can live in the lake. That's a very good example. Pretty big paper. I'm not positive. I haven't gone through the full list, but I think this is only the second paper that we've talked about on these core reading lists that won the Peters Award for the best publication by a student in Canada or a Canadian limnology student. So it won that award in 2017 or 2018, early in 2018. And Adam's paper in Science was the other one on that list. That's how I know for sure that there were at least two, and I don't think there were any others, so I may check in back. But yeah, a really interesting work. It was done with some data from, I mean, there's a bunch of data in there, but some ELA data. We've talked about the Experimental Lakes Area a few times on the podcast in a variety of contexts. So yeah, just a good paper, shows some interesting things, and really kind of gets at the so what, who cares about oxygen sort of component of the story, and does get cited for a wide range of reasons, it seems, not just physiologically about lake trout, not just about lake habitat change, not just methodologically. It's just used in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah, and I found it's just a good way to illustrate, like, the so what problem is definitely a big one. And in terms of even just talking to, like, my parents, for example, when you're trying to illustrate it, it's like, you know, chironomids and chironomid larvae and what kind of conditions they like and in their tubes on the benthos doesn't really necessarily translate very well to their general experiences. And so, but when you talk about, nope, you know, the top of the lake is too warm for the fish, so they avoid it, and the bottom of the lake is nice and cold the way they like it, but they can't actually breathe down there, so they're forced out of it as well. It's like, it just, you know, very quickly illustrates why you would want to reconstruct oxygen changes over time.
For sure. It just makes sense and is a easy to explain example, but backed up by some pretty cool data.
All right. Paper number two.
Number one done. Yeah, moving on.
Do you have a suggestion, Josh?
So I, unlike Adam, have not done a lot of work related to oxygen reconstructions, chironomid-based or not, in paleo. So as is often the case, my first interest in a topic is sorted out by pulling out that most critical of tomes, small 2008 JPS's little textbook on paleo environmental perspectives. And when I pulled up the oxygen chapter, the very first time, or the I'm not sure it's an oxygen chapter, but the first time oxygen is mentioned, the first reference about it is a paper by Rob McAreth from 1966 in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London, Series B, Biological Sciences. So old enough that it was before it was renamed Proceedings B. And that paper is called Some Chemical Observations on Post-Glacial lake sediments. So I don't know that we should choose that paper, but it is the first time it comes up.
It's like flag on the field. This is being disallowed. This is totally flies in the face of the kind of
rules you just described.
Yeah, it's like 53 pages. It's like more like a book than a paper. And yeah, it is.
All right. So not, we won't include it's it, not very, but let's give it an honorable mention that it is one of, as far as I could find, it's one of the earliest attempts to use sediments to reconstruct oxygen. It was using metal ratios, iron, manganese, metal ratios. So very different from what we'll continue to talk about.
So yeah, definitely interesting as a, you know, so what, 40, mm-hmm. you're almost 60 years ago now.
And it does, one of the best things is it says how much the edition cost, which I had no idea the units that it was in, 18 shillings. I mean, I've heard of it from like Oliver Twist or whatever.
Yeah. But it is predates decimalization in another the United Kingdom, which is when they converted from shillings to, or well, from pounds, but then went to 100 pennies to the pound instead of, is it 20 shillings, 18 shillings, something like that.
No idea.
But anyway, it's pretty interesting.
We did the math, and that came out to $24 Canadian in modern money. So that's how much it would have cost to get this edition or article. I'm not sure which it is. I think it might be the article.
Yeah.
Little digression there.
Yeah, which is kind of funny because it's like, quite in line with if you were just trying to get a individual article off the internet today, it would be.
Yep.
So I don't know if that is a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that paper is 53 pages. So, you know, you're getting a little more like a small book, as you say. Either way, digression, moving on. Maybe don't read that paper, but it's interesting to think about where it came from and how old these attempts are and how long it's been that people have been thinking about oxygen and how important it is.
Yeah. So definitely contextualizes, I guess, the amount of time this has been considered. Macbeth, in many ways, was a pioneer. We would have talked about him in the history episode a little while ago. But yes. Not really what I was thinking of when we first kind of kicked around the idea of a core reading list.
Perhaps not. So what shall we have for number two?
So I was going to switch to another one. So this is out of the Pearl Lab. Clerk et al. 2000. So this is in the Journal of Paleolimnology. So a little bit more recent. Only a quarter century-ish.
25 year.
and the title is... So Clerk et al. 2000, JOPL, Quantitative Inferences of Past Hypolimnetic Anoxia and Nutrient Levels from a Canadian Precambrian Shield Lake. And this is an example of a single core study that uses chronomers to examine the history of anoxia in an Ontario lake. And I typically flag this one of interest as it kind of predates the transfer functions that would be used today to reconstruct hypolimnetic flame weighted oxygen, for example, and instead focuses on a semi-quantitative variable called the anoxic factor, and is
sort
interesting.
Of a precursor to those ideas.
It was like, so it's still the development of the analytical approaches. So in some levels, this is quite similar to a chromed oxygen study you might see today in terms of the presentation, stratigraphy, but the anoxic factor is something that is, I mean, I would have to refresh my memory on exactly how it was calculated, but is basically just more, a semi-quantitative measure as opposed to trying to tell you the actual concentration per se of the oxygen within the water.
Right. Yeah. And was that just because I'm not familiar with this particularly. I'm just curious, had they just not gotten around to the methodology? I mean, certainly the methodology for transfer functions are there. There's also a diatom transfer function in this paper that's applied, the Hall and Small one, I assume, given Roland is on the paper as well. But it just hadn't been applied as broadly to the coronamid oxygen part of the story. Interesting.
Well, my understanding of this is largely because, kind of alluded to when talking about the Guzzo paper, but oxygen is a little bit more ephemeral and right. changes through time. So what exactly would a reconstruction be? And so you're trying to get does this lake go anoxic in the late fall? Is kind of what they're getting at. Because if you measure the concentration in the last week of August versus, you know, late October, right. you know, it's like the oxygen when the lake is stratified. I guess we didn't really talk about this off the top, but the idea being that, you know, when the lake stratifies and the hypolimnium is no longer has exposure to the atmosphere, no more oxygen is being dissolved into the water, making its way down into the bottom waters. So what is down there from the beginning of stratification is just going to be gradually consumed through the summer season until fall turnover. And so then it's like when you're the vagaries of a lot of this are kick in where you want to measure or reconstruct the minimum oxygen level right before fall turnover, but that's going to vary from lake to lake to lake and from year to year to year. Mm-hmm. And so these kind of approaches like the anoxic factor, which going into is beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today, of how it's actually calculated, but just that idea that it's like a moving target in many ways, and that led it to being a bit more complicated to attack from a paleolimnological sense than something like pH, where it's like, right. we measure the pH of the water, we'll look at the assemblages that are down there, and then relate optima that way through a calibration set.
Right, that makes so much sense. Yeah, exactly. It has to do with the timing, what it is you're reconstructing, and the fact that pH doesn't really change that much throughout the year in comparison to something like oxygen. Because I believe there is a coronamid TP model applied in this paper as well, in addition to the diatom. So it's really getting at that oxygen story. Cool.
And that leads directly into the next paper, which then is Quinlan and Small 2001, where they do develop a transfer function to reconstruct volume-weighted hypolimnic oxygen. And so it's Quinlan and Small 2001, coronamid-based inference models for estimating end-of-summer hypolimnetic oxygen from South Central Ontario shield lakes. And this is in Freshwater Biology, volume 46, starts on page 1529. And this is describing the initial development of the VWHO model. So volume-weighted hypolimnetic oxygen. So this is where they've gone one step further and incorporated the bathymetry of the lake into oxygen measurements at the end of the summer, trying to capture that minimum value and then calibrate the coronamid assemblages against those values in a calibration set to reconstruct.
And only a year.
And only a year later. And this is Roberto Quinlan, professor now at York. And he was also involved in the previous one in the office on the previous paper as well.
And this was during his postdoc that I think he was, I mean, he was probably, it is PhD research, but came out during his postdoc by that point. Very interesting. Yeah, you can see the, I don't want to say evolution. It's not really a direct evolution, but the change in methodology and as a different way of getting at a similar kind of question.
Yeah. And there's a bit of a flow there in terms of one goes very much into the other of, you know, a refinement of methodology, I guess.
Yep.
But it's also in there to give an appreciation, or in the past when distributed a list like this, to give an appreciation of, you know, the difficulties and getting these numbers that are being calibrated against.
And I would assume, I certainly don't know, but quite quickly, it replaced the idea of the anoxic factor. Like, you don't see that being applied, at least in maybe the circle. I mean, we obviously work closely with John and Roberto. So it may just be the group that you're tied into, but probably switched quite quickly.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then I'd also, it's disappeared from the list for some reason, add a, I guess, so that was one, two,
that was number three.
And then tack in a 3B, which is Quinlan Small 2010. I lost the actual paper though. Okay. Where there was a follow-up paper that added Keobrids to the model to improve the model performance at the hypoxic end of the range. So the same model was expanded with some like an additional group. So it's a broader midge model, includes your chronomid assemblage along with the presence of Keobrids as well, or like the relative abundance of Keobrids in a midge assemblage is then incorporated into the model as well. And it's an improved model over time.
And it improves the performance of the model for a fairly small number of taxa added, I imagine.
Yeah. So basically, it basically works in effectively, the presence of of some Keobrids, like Keobrids americanus, that are able to withstand hypoxia, if not anoxia, for low for periods of time. So the presence of them in the assemblage is basically telling you that your oxygen basically drops to zero over time. And so that is used to bump up model performance at the low end.
That's interesting. That's such a small, I mean, there's obviously a lot of work that goes into getting that, but in terms of data contribution to the model, it's a pretty small difference. Is it presence, absence, or a basic abundance of only one other group, yet can tell you quite a bit? So it's not always you need thousands of extra taxa to make a difference in the model if they're the right species for the question.
And it's interesting in that because, they're chitinized. You would have found them in you've always been finding them in your chronomid trays everywhere. And it's a case of, they were not necessarily initially being looked at that closely. And then it's like, once, how about we actually track how many of these we find? Because how often, on slides and whatnot, do you see stuff that is not related to what you're looking at? And it's kind of like building that in, because I can't think of too many other examples where you would add another indicator group to like a diatom model or something like that. It's like, let's add plant stomatocysts somehow into our calibration set. I don't think of anything similar to that happening very often.
I can't think of any. I mean, we look at some ratios and stuff, but they're not incorporated into a training set. They would be done separately.
Yeah, like the sponge spicules or something like that don't get incorporated into the diatom calibration set at all. So.
Or even things that are more close, like chrysophytes. It's a different group.
Yeah.
Whereas these are different groups of midges, different habitats, but can still tell you some interesting things. That's very neat. I'm learning stuff in this one, Adam.
You're not supposed to be learning stuff. You're supposed to be knowing this stuff. Come on, you got to project confidence.
No, we can always continue to learn. Lifelong learner, especially about the beautiful field of paleolimnology. All right, so that was 3B. Let's move on to number 4. And I think I picked this one, which is a strange one because I don't really know anything about this. Beyond what we talked about in what episode was A Smidge of Midges. That was my exhaustive knowledge on coronals.
Yeah, that was a while ago. I don't remember when that
was. Yeah, 36, I think we said earlier. Okay. Anyway, so when I was looking for oxygen coronamid papers, just Google Scholar searching, this one came up a lot. And I then looked, as you often do, at the articles that cite this paper, and it seems that since this paper by Broderson et al. Came out in 2004, effectively every paleolimnology paper that is based on chironomids and even mentions the word oxygen cites it. So I think that makes it a well-worthy addition to our list. So continuing with its information, it's in Limnology and Oceanography, and the title is Chironomids, Diptera, and Oxyregulatory Capacity, an Experimental Approach to Paleolimnological Interpretation. So very different. You know, we have a lab analysis, lab experimental analysis, but one that is, well, directly applicable to paleolimnological, paleoclimate types of studies, as shown in the title. And we're not in any way affiliated with these researchers from Denmark. I think they're Danish.
Yes.
But clearly informs a lot of the paleo chironomid oxygen research that has come since its publication.
Yeah, because I think...
Have you read this paper?
I have read this paper.
Oh, good.
It's been a while since I've read it in depth. But it kind of blows my mind as one of these papers where this is absolutely fascinating, and I'm very glad that somebody did this, but that would never have been me. But basically, it's an experimental approach, and they basically isolated 16 chironomid taxa and then measured their respiration in like custom-built respiration chambers to determine their oxygen uptake, and then
crazy
compared that with the calibration set that they collected of 52 Greenland lakes. And so it's kind of experimental approach to paleo, so calibrating the set in a different way, instead of going, this is the measurements in the lakes and this is what we find there. It was more a case, again, because we said earlier how hard it is to measure the oxygen at the period of time that you might be most interested in. So it was like, all right, let's classify these individual chironomids as, what's the term, by their oxyregulatory capacity, and then go and revisit the lakes to see the assemblages from the most oxygen demanding to, you know, most tolerant of low oxygen conditions. And and so this kind of, it's just neat.
Yeah, it is just neat, exactly. I would love to see a picture of these little custom-made respiration chambers. I didn't see one in the paper as I flipped through it, unfortunately. But it is just, as you say, a neat combination of methods with a very specific goal to understand the system better in order to inform future research, which it clearly did because it is cited by every paleo paper on chironomids and oxygen since.
Absolutely. And it's just, especially in this kind of list of like just showing the range of approaches and data and ways that have been attempted to just understand this part of limnological systems better.
Yep. All right. Let's bring it home. Number five. What shall it be?
This one falls in the realm of if the rest have a very clear kind of, you know, following a development pathway. This one, the final one, is a little bit more of a cautionary tale. It's like coming at oxygen reconstruction slightly differently. So this is a... Stuart et al. From 2013, a paper out of the ProLab group again, published in JOPL, contrasting the effects of climatic nutrient and oxygen dynamics on subfossil chironomid assemblages, a paleolimnological experiment from eutrophic high Arctic ponds.
They didn't charge by the number of characters in the title. It's a long one.
They did not. And so I think... We alluded, or you mentioned it in the Clerkenau paper. So what was that, number two?
Three? Two?
How they're also looking at chronomids as a nutrient indicator.
Yes.
And so kind of there's a bit of a question in some cases of like, in certain conditions, are the chronomids responding to nutrient enrichment or oxygen depletion? You know, it's like there's a bit of a push-pull going there because those two phenomena are quite closely related. And
in most cases,
And so you had a case of, I think we've talked about before with like the colonial seabirds of like the paired paleolimnological study approach. And they were able to examine two closely related lakes where because they were shallow and had a large seabird colony very close by would be both high, very oxygen rich and very nutrient rich at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we're able to tease apart that kind of push-pull a little bit because it wasn't there. Or it was, both were high in the same system.
Right. Break apart the things that generally are locked together. Low oxygen, high nutrients tend to be locked in sync with one another and co-vary. And lo and behold, if you look hard enough, you can probably find examples where those things don't happen. You may have to go to a small pond in the high Arctic that's surrounded by bird nests, but they can be teased apart in theory.
But what they found
and in practice
was that even though the nutrient levels were essentially off the charts, the assemblages were dominated by like cold stenotherms that in temperate regions would be used to identify oligotrophic conditions.
Right.
And
so not what you might expect if a model was strongly driven by the total phosphorus concentration.
And so, and so like the paper basically indicates that when both of these things are in abundance at the same time, it's the, it's like the oxygen driving the assemblage more so than the nutrient availability.
Very interesting. I remember this paper when Emily was working on it. It was right as I was leaving to go to postdoc in Jules's lab, actually. Jenny was going to postdoc in Jules's lab, going to Ottawa. And there was quite a bit of I don't want to say buzz around this as it was being put together. But it is an interesting testing of a hypothesis, a really cool example of how you can do that with paleo.
Yeah, it has definitely caused some discussion.
Yes.
And and so I think that would be the, you know, if you're going to put a list together, a combination of the why, methodological approaches, and a cautionary tale to the application of said methodological approaches.
Yeah, I think this is a good list.
And so, so
maybe one of the more like well-rounded of them from different aspects.
Yeah. And then I think the one honorable mention I would put on there as a case of, you know, a key chronomid text that I probably looked at more than any other, it'd be a taxonomic key.
Sure, but you don't hand that off to be read by someone in advance necessarily, but I the point is well taken.
Yes. And so Brooks et al. 2007, the identification and use of Palearctic chronomidae larvae in paleoecology. It's a technical guide. I don't even know how you'd go about acquiring new copies of that today. I just remember we had a couple.
I'm not sure if you, but yeah, we have one.
If it's still in print, but
I'm not positive that Emily didn't bring it because she was a postdoc with Jenny, and it's possible she had her own copy and left it for us. So I don't honestly know the answer to that one. Interesting.
And so once again, this is very much our list. You may disagree. That's fine. We don't care. These are the papers that we would and have send in a Welcome to the Project type of email. And I think this is where we normally throw in some anecdotal stories of like things that didn't quite make it into the list. And I think there are a couple of interesting things, especially when you're dealing with model data, is the phenomenon of when the model data is not included in the paper. I always find that a bit, I don't know. I see both elements of wanting to be involved in the application of the model, but then at the same time wanting the model to be as widely used as possible. I definitely had a formative. I remember seeing a presentation early in my master's where there was a not even model, but it was just data from like a thesis that had been uncovered from like, I don't know, 100 years ago, but they put the full spreadsheet equivalents of like data tables in the back of the thing and were able to revisit it. And I was like, you don't want your work to disappear.
Yeah, for sure. Well, data availability is a discussion more broad than this, in a lot of fields, not just paleolimnology. And raw data are one thing, but you know, the actual models themselves that are built on it, that's another question. Some people have, lots of people have differing opinions on the procedure for doing those things. And those opinions change over time. The models that were built in the 90s, the opportunity to have them available on repositories, GitHub, those kind of things just didn't exist. So it has changed. I think you probably find more models are available now.
I think in many ways.
Packages in R.
Be a requirement of publication in many cases.
A lot of times it is. Yep.
Which is interesting when you're looking at papers from like 25 years ago of just the, you know, the philosophical shift, I guess, over that time.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Maybe that's a topic for another episode, but it is an interesting one to keep in mind, because a lot of the models that are applied for paleo in general are getting quite old, and that leads into the next discussion, is like, how long can we continue to apply models that were built in the 90s, early 2000s? You know, we're moving 20 years on since those models, and in some cases the actual samples for water chemistry, for sediment, may have been taken some number of years before that as well. It might be pushing 30 years of change in that environment. So do models age out?
I would.
What does that look like?
Well, I think, you know, this aging out of old data is something we've touched on in a couple of general topics in terms of like lead-210, and then, you know, going back 150 years now, if you're talking about like, it was one thing when we were talking about the 1850s in our region of the world in terms of initial land clearances and stuff. But now, like 30 years later, you're talking about the 1880s and things were, you know, like the changes were underway in many ways. And in the same vein, especially when talking about volume-weighted hypolimnetic oxygen, the bathymetry of the lake has not changed. Or in very few cases will have changed over the past 25 years. But what will have changed is the length of the stratification period. Mm-hmm. So as summers get longer and the fall turnover is potentially pushed back, you know, maybe on average by, you know, a couple of weeks at this point, in some cases, you know, lakes that did not go hypoxic in the 90s, that same amount of oxygen has to last an extra 2 weeks now. So, I think in some cases, if you went and remeasured the oxygen immediately before fall turnover, there'd be some differences today. And, you know, what would the changes impact? How would those changes impact the actual calibration model? I do not know.
And I imagine at some points that question will be tested explicitly by returning to one of these models and redoing all of the work, not just adding in extra counts and those kind of things. And maybe it has been done in other locations. I don't know that particularly well. But it is definitely an interesting consideration. As you say, climate is certainly changing. Yes, that turnover in the fall was getting later, but also the ice probably came off earlier. Temperatures were hotter. Production was higher. BOD is likely higher. So there's a lot going on in a warming lake. Anything else that jumped out at you as we were working our way through prepping for this or the actual discussion?
Yeah, I think one last thing that I made scribbles about, and I've lost the actual citations now, but I'll include them in the eventual show notes. We're out
of practice at this.
It disappeared on me. I'm blaming a technical mishap. Dog ate my homework.
It happens. always.
But the same idea basically coming out in two different papers at the same time. And so it doesn't necessarily fit within oxygen reconstructions directly, so it didn't make any sense within the list. But in order to do oxygen reconstructions, you need to characterize chondromate assemblage, and there's an obvious question there of, because it's a very time-intensive activity in terms of isolating the chondromate head capsules from the sediments. How many do you require to adequately characterize the assemblage? And that there were two 2001 papers from two different lab groups, both attacking that at the same time. And it was
interesting, Isabella Rocks, the lead on one, and Roberto the other. Is that
right? That is right.
Sounds familiar.
And if you can just cover me for a second, I can pull up those papers.
How quickly Adam can Google away. And this has been done for other indicators. Like it's sort of built into the deeper manuals, and there was a lot of kind of effort to determine how much counting effort is needed to adequately characterize the assemblage of, for example, the diatoms. It's been done for the cladocera, I think we mentioned. Josh Couric did a similar thing during his time at Queen's to consider how many cladocera needed to be enumerated. But one of the different things we've talked about, and Adam's right, it doesn't really fit into this oxygen discussion, but if you had just a chironomid literature list, this would certainly be a good included component, is that the method for identifying and isolating chironomids is quite different. So the picking aspect is quite different than scanning slides like it is for cladocera or diatoms. And just based on abundance, it uses a ton of sediment when there's not that many of
them. You run out, you know, there's a danger of running out. You don't have the ability to just do one more transect or something like that.
Or one more, I'll make another slide. I'll take another aliquot out of my diatom slurry, of which I could make 100 slides if I needed to, or something like
that. Yeah, and so definitely around the same time, two key interests in quantifying, and in two different lab groups, and very much came to a very, very similar answer, which is also kind of cool. So you don't often see. So this is Quinlan and Small in Journal of Paleolimnology 2001, setting minimum head capsule abundance and taxa deletion criteria in chondromid based inference models. And the very, very similar paper is by Isabel Larocque in Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, and Paleoecology. How many chondromid head capsules are enough? A statistical approach to determine sample size for paleoclimatic reconstructions.
Interesting.
And these two were submitted to the journals within like 2 weeks of each other, I think.
Wow.
3 weeks of each other.
Still close.
So very, very close. And they both basically came to the general idea that in the vast majority of samples, 50 head capsules was enough in one case to obtain a temperature reconstruction similar to one obtained by counting 150 more or more head capsules. So tripling the effort did not improve model performance very much. And then that's
good to know. You wouldn't want to go the other way.
Absolutely. And then the converse was very similar. Minimum abundance of 40 to 50 head capsules sufficient for use in inference models. So
good stuff.
And anyway, so it's kind of very much an aside to what we're talking about, but just a neat little kind of methodological footnote to this whole kind of analytical approach.
Very good. I think that was a good list. I've enjoyed this one. I did, as I said, learned a few things, and I like the variety, just the different tacts and all of it linked to one topic.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of where, when it's grown out of, it's just like, you know, a mishmash of different, even types of analyses or topics of study that will all pull together in many chronomid auction analyses.
All right.
There we go. Another one in the
next
books.
The next one's number 50. Number 50. Big numbers. We got something special planned for that one. Stay tuned. Keep it secret maybe until then. Do we have anything in the mailbag this month?
I did not check today, but as of a couple of days ago, the answer was no.
So we can assume anything is not so pressing that it can't wait until next time.
You know, a statistical analysis of our mail suggests that you do not need to check it every single day.
Yes, correct.
But anyway, once again, thank you for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology Podcast. If you have a question or a comment or a suggestion for a future show, please send us a note.
And you can do so via email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com, or you could send them via Twitter. We haven't been very good about checking Twitter. I've kind of left Twitter in general personally, but it's still there. We still check it occasionally, and that is @coreideaspaleo. We do read everything eventually.
An archive of our past episodes and show notes is maintained on our website at coreideas.ajezierski.ca. But the easiest way to find the link is just to look up our Twitter bio.
That's right. And you can also find it on some of the podcast pages. So if you're on one of those sites, SoundCloud, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get those podcasts, we would be very appreciative if you give us a rating, maybe a 5-star rating, and leave a comment and subscribe.
And that's it for today. But we will be back soon-ish to provide one more core reading list related to paleolimnology, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.